If you're haunted and harassed by your own inner critic, if you've ever been curious about why hypnosis works so well, if you're a seasoned hypnotist, or if you suspect that the inner critic is actually hypnotizing you to hold back from reaching the greatness that you know deep down is inside you, lean in and get inspired to get out of your comfort zone and create your one precious life with purpose and intention. If you like this show, you'll love my powerful hypnosis audio, The Answer Room, because it gives you crystal clear guidance and direction and illuminates an ingenious way to make triumphant decisions, no matter how stuck you feel or how confused you were. This powerful hypnosis audio is my gift to you when you go to theimpostermonster.com. Again, that's theimpostermonster.com. Don't forget the. Theimpostermonster.com. And yes, I'm done saying it. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for listening. I'm Lori Hammond, and I'm truly grateful for you. Welcome, everyone. I am so excited for today's guest, Chase Hughes. I heard him speak at HypnoThoughts a few months ago, and he was one of the most, probably the most captivating speaker I have ever listened to. I hung on every word, the entire audience hung on every word, and I think you are going to hang on every word in this interview today. Chase Hughes is the CEO of Applied Behavior Research. After 20 years in the US military, Chase is a leading expert in behavior profiling, influence, and interrogation. He teaches the most elite government and business teams in the world and is the author of The Ellipsis Manual, which is the number one best-selling book on persuasion, people reading, and influence. Chase has been featured in Entrepreneur Magazine for bringing Jason Bourne skills to business. He teaches military units, intelligence organizations, business, police, and corporate executives cutting-edge behavior skills such as rapid behavior profiling and enhanced persuasion techniques. His company also teaches jury selection, people reading, and human intelligence courses around the world. Chase created the groundbreaking interrogation behavioral analysis tool, the Behavioral Table of Elements, and the TFCA cycle that revolutionized law enforcement training. He's also the creator of the Pre-Violence Indicators Index, designed to alert personnel to pre-attack behaviors and save lives. Chase Hughes was raised in Houston, Texas, and attended a military academy before joining the US Navy in 1998. He now lives in Virginia Beach, Virginia. After serving the United States and NATO countries for over 20 years, he's bringing his fascinating and effective technology to the most critical issues the world faces. Chase, thank you so much for being here today.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
I was so intrigued. So you and I met in August of last year, and I heard people talking about Chase Hughes, and somehow you had not come on my radar yet. And I went up to listen to your presentation. And when I got there, it was, they had closed the doors. They weren't letting anyone else in because it was at capacity during COVID. So there were like a half dozen of us sitting outside the door, leaning in, straining to hear. And it was just, I thought, how have I not discovered this guy sooner? You just delivered massive, massive value. And I think you were slated for a 1 hour presentation. And the person who was supposed to talk after you canceled. So people said, keep going, keep going. And it was 3 hours in and they were trying to get you to stay even longer. So
that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. What was your introduction to being in an audience of hypnotists like?
It was interesting. I mean, there's such a diverse group of people that all kind of wanted the same thing, that all wanted to explore different ways to help other people. And I think hypnosis has been proven in very many academic articles and medical journals even to bring some profound impact to people's health. And I think it's a great, I really don't like the word modality, but it's a great technique to use to help people. It's very effective.
talk to me a little bit about your introduction to hypnosis. I think you talked about your girlfriend, Michelle, saying, let's watch this stage show. And I'll let you take it from there.
So my girlfriend, that was not my introduction to hypnosis. That was definitely the first time I'd seen a stage show, for sure. So I started studying hypnosis when I was much younger. I was 19 years old, and I basically memorized the Big Red Book of hypnotic. It's called Hypnotic Suggestions and Metaphors by D. Corydon Hammond, the chief editor. It's a big book. And I spent a long time memorizing that. And I think that was before I hypnotized anybody. And it really helped me to understand how suggestion works and what we respond to and how people respond differently to stuff. And being in the military at the time, I thought, surely, you know, the government's got a bunch of this stuff figured out. And I thought Jason Bourne level stuff actually existed. And going to some of these intelligence courses, recruiting courses, all this stuff that they had, it felt like How to Win Friends and Influence People. It was the most basic stuff, like, hey guys, look, make good eye contact when you talk to people, give people a firm handshake, use their name, touch them on the shoulder every once in a while, and that's it, everybody, that's the course. So it was kind of like that. And I thought, there's no way. It cannot be possible that we don't have anything more advanced than that. And we didn't. Granted, there was some interrogation stuff that's very effective, but it didn't leverage influence. It only leveraged interrogation. So there was a huge hole. And I worked for 20 years to try to fill that hole and make sure that there was some cohesion there between some of these super advanced techniques that don't take a lot of practice to get good at, that they can start leveraging. So the whole thing was me wanting to level up our ability to get intelligence out of people in the field. And I had no idea that this could be leveraged in the same exact techniques for enhanced interrogation or intelligence collection can be used in a therapeutic context or parenting your kids or convincing a friend to go to a new Mexican restaurant. All of this stuff is the same skill. So we hear people say, oh, I'm in B2C sales or B2B sales or whatever. It's the same thing. It's human to human. No one sells to a business. You're selling to a human in that business. So it's all that human skill that I got obsessed with growing up.
I've been so curious what your background in hypnosis is, because when I look through your, I was going to say when I read through your ellipsis manual, but I'm not that ambitious. I will literally like let it fall open and just read a page. And there's always some really cool revelation in there. And it's so aligned with what I've learned as a hypnotist. And so I was curious what your background is. Do you position your stuff as hypnosis or... And do you have formal hypnosis training?
I do. I do have several certifications in hypnosis, and I have advanced certificates in everything from neuroscience. I have advanced certifications in neuroscience from Harvard University, and I've got advanced hypnosis or hypnotherapy certificates from different accreditation agencies, most notably the Richard Nongard's agency.
That's awesome. I have wondered about that. So Chase, most of the people listening to this podcast, or at least in my mind, the people listening to this podcast are hypnotists who have some level of training or perhaps are midway through a training, and they have a glimpse into the transformational power that these tools have, but they're afraid to use it. They, you know, there's this dialogue going on inside saying, what if I screw up? What if I forget the words? What if I don't do this protocol just right?
Right.
What would you say to someone in that situation?
I've discovered if you've got, I've talked to a lot of hypnotists, and I won't single anybody out, but everyone wants to get deep into this nuance. And so they're like, oh, but I like to do when I'm practicing is I like to tap the shoulder 3 times and have a banana peel under their chair and then take a look at their fingernails and see if they're purple or red or white, and just like crazy amounts of nuance. But one thing I notice is that these people aren't brilliant on the basic elements to begin with. And I think that if you just get the basics down, that's a tremendous benefit over all of this other little tiny nuanced little language tricks and little tweaks and how, you know, we deliver one of these suggestions, or I need this perfect script with these exact words on it. None of that stuff matters if you've got the basics down. And I think the number one skill is going to be confidence in all of this, because I could take a person who's read every book on hypnosis, has it 100% memorized, knows every script that Milton Erickson has ever uttered out of his mouth, and give those skills versus a person with a tremendous level of social skill and confidence and teach them hypnosis in 5 minutes or less, they're going to smoke that other person. So that person with the high social skills, high confidence, is going to smoke the person with all the knowledge and all the book skills every single time. And that's one of those key factors. So if we know, we all inherently believe and know that that situation is true. Even in sales, it's not the guy with all the tactics that's the head sales guy. It's the guy that can talk to anybody. He can read anybody. He can connect with people really easily. It's not because he studied the fill in the blank sales system, sales training system. So we tend to attribute those things to whether or not we're successful, because it's a lot easier than saying, well, it's me. It's easier to blame it on a system or blame it on a script when we fail. And so much of what confidence is, the reason a lot of people struggle with it is because they're waiting for permission. I need to see some kind of evidence around me. These people need to behave a certain way. I need to be here for a reason. I need to be wearing a certain piece of clothing. I need to have a reason to feel confident or some kind of permission. And it comes down to permission. And I can tell you, if you're watching or listening to the podcast, no one's coming to save you. No one is going to tap you on the shoulder and give you permission to feel confident. No one's coming. And you don't need it. You really don't need the permission. And if we look at like extreme examples of this, the movie Catch Me If You Can, this is a world-class con artist. He knows nothing, zero, about how to fly a plane, but he's got everybody fooled because he has this overconfidence. And I think people who have confidence, whether it be real or fake, they have the same effect, the exact same effect on the people around us. And confidence is something that gives you an unfair advantage over other people. You get out of speeding tickets, you get shorter jail term sentences. And these are all absolutely proven by research. You will get a raise faster than other people. You get promoted. You're more likely to get selected for jobs. So that is such a trait that it's hard to define. And I've struggled to define it a long time, but I think it comes down to a few things. Number one is you need to know that no matter how confident somebody is, including me right now, everybody's faking it. Everybody feels like they're faking it. I don't care who you talk to or who you deal with. Everybody has that feeling of like, well, I'm faking it. Only some people are just like, and that's okay. And we can just follow that up with, and that's fine because everyone else is. So just understanding that everyone else is going through the same thing you are is a huge first step. The second step is giving yourself permission. And the third step is understanding that in our brain, we have a thing called the limbic system. And 500,000 years ago, this kept us safe from saber-toothed tigers. So when you start feeling confident, what happens is we feel this fear like, oh crap, something bad might happen. And what winds up happening is our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, and we feel this existential fear. The reason we're feeling that is because the brain 500,000 years ago is the same as today. It hasn't changed. We might have an iPhone 12 or whatever kind of iPad you got, but the brain hasn't changed. So I promise you that what it's trying to do is protect you from a saber-toothed tiger. And I am not joking. So you've got to know that that is, that natural fear response is there to protect you, but it's made to protect you from tigers. It doesn't really do much good now. But understanding there's no vaccination to get rid of that. Like, you're not going to meditate your way out of 600 million years of evolution. It's not going to happen. But understanding that and understanding the concept, like, that's, I have control over this a little bit, but I can choose to receive that message and say, thanks for trying to help. That would have been really badass 200,000 years ago, but it's not very helpful right now. I'm not in danger. And just remember the phrase, write it on a notepad, on your bathroom mirror, wherever you need to remember it. There are no tigers. And that's the biggest barrier to confidence, is a fear of saber-toothed tigers.
This is so awesome. I feel like if someone were just to listen to that last 5 minutes of this podcast and really internalize that and embed that into their psyche, that it would be absolutely transformative. So for a person who feels like they don't have, that they lack that confidence and they don't know, maybe they don't even know what confidence looks like, is there any, how would you guide them to starting to cultivate that confidence and just to fake it and to show up in a more confident way?
So let's, I'd like to remove the word fake.
Completely. Okay, that's fine.
The people who have real confidence is still fake. They just got away with it for so long that they saw what we all look for, evidence. They got evidence that they were okay to act that way. They're still faking it. They just haven't been punished for it. So that's all it is a lifetime of evidence of, I acted confident, nothing bad happened, I can try it again. And that's how you can do it for yourself. And a lot of times when we're trying to quote unquote fake it, what we're doing is thinking that it's fake. That reminds us that it's fake. There's no such thing as fake confidence. You're confident or you're not. So start by physiologically manipulating yourself. And keep in mind that little part of our brain, the little middle part, I usually have my brain on screen, but that little middle part is not under conscious control. It is to an extent. But if you think you can really control your brain from a conscious level, I don't care what Buddhist monk you talk to who meditated for 10 years, try holding your breath until you die. You can't do it. The reason is because that thing takes over. No matter how much you want to do it, that thing is going to take over. And the reason that is that kept us alive. So the reason influence works, the reason a person becomes really influential is because they're triggering things that kept our ancestors alive. So the reason we watch an infomercial, or the reason we start becoming more obedient to authority figures, is because it kept us alive a million years ago. And there's four factors, you know, that kept our ancestors alive, and they spell out the word fate, F-A-T-E. So the first one is focus. So anything that had our focus helped us to survive. And the first thing I teach in influence is focus is your currency. That's the number one thing that you're working with clients or patients or your kids, is focus in a conversation. People say we've lost our attention spans, or our attention spans are going down over time because of social media. I disagree, because the same person who can't watch 3 seconds of an Instagram video or is addicted to like these short TikTok videos, that same person who we say, oh, he has an attention span of a squirrel, they can still go watch Game of Thrones for 19 hours, eating Cheetos in a marathon Game of Thrones run. So it's not the attention deficit, it's an interest deficit for many people. And I'm not talking about the disorder, I'm talking about society as a whole. So it's not really an attention problem, it's an interest problem. So our goal needs to be to produce focus and interest in who we speak to, the way we speak. The second one is A, which is authority. We're naturally obedient. When something triggers our primal brain that this is an authority figure, I need to listen to them, we are naturally compliant. Automatically, without our understanding, we become compliant. Next is tribe. What are the people doing around me? Is it okay to do this in this area? Because our tribe is a really big deal. Do I have social permission? And sometimes the authority that people are obedient to is just, it's not one person. It's just everyone else is doing this. I'm going to do that too. Because that kept us alive. That literally kept us alive. And if the tribe didn't like you, you're either A, dead, or B, can't have sex, which means you don't pass on your DNA and you stop existing. And it's pretty simple. But if you're watching this and you're lacking confidence, keep faith that none of your ancestors died a virgin. They all made it. But the final part of that fate is emotion. So emotion means that if our ancestors felt really strongly about something and it kept them alive or they avoided something, this sounds really ridiculous and kind of out there, but there's thousands of scholarly articles, including from Cambridge, Oxford, Harvard, Yale, that our ancestors can pass down memories to us. Not in the form of, oh, I remember my great uncle being breastfed or anything like that, but we can inherit a phobia from an ancestor, an actual fear of certain things. Babies are afraid of snakes and spiders. Why? Why are we born knowing how to smile and frown and communicate nonverbally? We're born with those things. And there's even some stuff we're born with that's not in our brain or in our spinal cord. I'm not going to turn this into a college lecture, but we have like some parts of our body can function without our brain, like the ability to walk, our legs. Our brain's not involved. So we have what's called a dually positive charged axons or nerve cells, where one is called an excitatory neuron, and it's connected to another excitatory neuron somewhere in the spinal cord. And you can see this if you ever held, like Lori, I know you've got grandkids. I think you do.
Yes.
If you hold a little baby over a coffee table or over the kitchen table or right above the floor, you can see their legs start to move. That's in the spinal cord. They're not thinking, that's not a conscious process. So that's their primitive brain from millions of years ago saying, there's ground nearby and activating that neuronal system. It's pretty cool.
That is intriguing. Have you read the book, The Alter Ego Effect by Todd Herman?
Yes, I have.
I would love to hear your thoughts on it because he talks about how, you know, stepping into a persona essentially. And I saw him in an interview with Tom Bilyeu say, this isn't faking it till you make it. It's actually unlocking and activating an attribute that you already have that's perhaps lying dormant inside you. And I know a lot of times when I try to teach people to change their state and to show up with confidence, even if they don't feel it, yeah, that if they can understand that, if they can conceive of confidence, you know, if they can watch Batman and see Bruce Wayne show up, you know, like this in his suit, that they can access that themselves. So I'd love to hear your take on that.
I agree. And I think when he's talking about the alter ego or a persona, that persona is permission. Because the persona gives me permission to act a certain way. So let's imagine you work in an office building and way down the road, there's a super expensive store. Let's say it's like Versace or something ridiculous, like where everything's like 10 grand for stupid stuff. And if you ever walked in there on your own, I know I would. I'd feel like, I know I'm not going to ever buy anything in this place. Probably can't afford anything in here. They're going to know. They're going to see me and they're going to know that I don't belong here. So now I'm giving myself those attributes by thinking about them. But what if I had a role? And think about the word role. And I'm talking about like starring in an actor's role or something like that, which is similar to an alter ego. What if I had a role there and I was supposed to be there? So what if the boss of my company gave me the company's badass platinum card and said, go down there and buy a bunch of crap for these guys that are coming to visit from Dubai. And we got a big business meeting. We need to get some really expensive gifts. How would you walk into that store differently? Knowing you're going to buy stuff, knowing that you're there, you didn't need an alter ego. You just needed the permission and you needed a role. And that's typically what most people need. And you can do the alter ego thing. I think it detracts from ourself because it makes us dissociate from who we are. So at the end of the day, since we're always looking for evidence, that wasn't us who got the evidence. That was the alter ego. So now the person who was confident was the person who wasn't me. I'm literally defining as somebody different than I am. And I think you deserve the credit. So maybe just try that idea on.
I love that. Can you talk about permission in the context of a client therapist relationship? I've heard you talk about how, you know, the idea of suggestibility and permission have a lot to do with that context. Could you talk to me a little bit about suggestibility and permission?
Yeah. So I think permission it's the start and the end of the game. There's a bunch of stuff in between that we definitely don't have time for, but it would start with you. So let's say I'm just giving you the advice. So it starts with you having permission to feel that in yourself. I have a role here. I have absolute permission to be the most confident person here. And I want you to think of confidence as if it makes someone else feel small, it's fake. Mm. It's absolutely not real confidence. Genuine confidence is contagious. It makes other people feel confident. If you look at the term con man, it's not because they feel confident and they trick you. It's because they give you confidence. They transfer it to you. So the genuine confidence comes from the ability to transfer it to other people. Because if I'm confident in myself, I'm giving you the same confidence in me. So that's where that kind of stems from. And I think so that down this long chain, I have permission. I'm giving myself permission to feel completely confident. And at the end of the road, that ends with you having permission to do something that you normally would not, which is what we want for all of our clients. At the end of the day, suggestibility is a measurable trait. So we have a part of our brain called the salience network, which is mostly up inside the prefrontal cortex. And the salience network is what we would use if we're like right now, we're both talking to each other and you and I are both on. You know what I mean? We're both kind of switched on, paying attention, hyper-focused into an area. So that's called the salience network. And people with a high level salience network are unhypnotizable. And the higher the salience network, the closer we get to what we call schizophrenia. And we have schizophrenic people are traditionally the number one hardest people to hypnotize on planet Earth. Even the champion researcher at Stanford University, his name's Dr. David Gibbons, has proven this multiple times, and this is well documented. But there's another part of the brain called the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus, or the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. And this part of the brain is kind of like a little radar. And this is really cool. They did this all in fMRI studies with low hypnotizable people and high hypnotizable people. And this is an academic research at Stanford University into hypnosis, which I'm all about. And what we found in the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus was that the activity went way up. And this is we have a premotor cortex. When we're imagining ourselves doing something, we're imagining movement, we're imagining our bodies moving. That went way up, and the salience network went way down. So this little part, it's actually right here under my finger, is the part that goes down. So that little piece of your brain, if I was to burn it, or lesion, what we call a lesion in neuroscience, you would stop worrying about things around you. So that part of the brain, if I'm an air traffic controller, my salience network has to be very high. I have to always be wondering, where's the next threat? What's going to happen? What could possibly hurt me? But I'm looking at a screen. And if I'm a bodyguard, a secret service person, salience network is extremely high in those people. So what we saw is a dramatic reduction in the salience network of the brain, which is where we worry about what could possibly hurt us in the surrounding environment. People who were low hypnotizables showed no reduction or very little reduction in that area. But what's important here is that when people do research about hypnosis in a laboratory or a university, it's horrible. So we have some kind of a douchebag guy in a lab coat reading some hypnotic script off of a clipboard to a guy laying in an MRI with this loud ass magnet clanging around in this circle. And that's how they measure, oh, this guy's hypnotizable. The good result of that is the hypnosis is so crappy that when they found someone who was hypnotizable, they were very hypnotizable. So we really got to measure that on high suggestible subjects. And we got to see a neurological and neurophysiological component of suggestibility. And that's really cool. But if we think about it, and we go back to our earlier conversation, if I'm a good influencer, that means I lower activity in your salience network, which is, it's called the DMPFC, the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, if you ever want to look that up. That means I'm lowering activity in your dorsomedial. So what that means is when I'm confident and I'm transferring it to you in a hypnotic setting, I'm lowering your concern because you feel confident. The more confident you feel, I'm lowering your concern for what might hurt you in the environment.
And that's going to increase suggestibility. I'm trying to remember, I re-listened to your talk at HypnoThoughts, and you were talking about the idea of suggestibility versus permission and how so much of that has to do with, 80% of that is due to the persuader. And then I think you said something like 10% is due to the technique, and then 10% is the persuadee, the client or the recipient.
Yeah. And I only say that not because I did some studies. That's a broad, big, fat paintbrush generalization on that idea. I'm just saying that the majority of what goes on in your clients or whether or not they're suggestible or hypnotizable is going to be down to you. And it sucks. It sucks to say that. Because you'll hear a lot of times when people say, oh, well, I had a client, but they're really not very hypnotizable. Well, it depends on the hypnotist, I think. And it depends on the environment. Were they being bullied that morning on Facebook? Did someone leave a horrible comment about them online right before they came into the office? And your ability to detect those things is very important because you can then modify them. But if you don't know they're there, and there's some small little things we don't notice, we'll just call them not hypnotizable and kick them out of the office, ask them for a referral, call them every 6 months.
Yeah. So I know you talk a lot about reading body language, and you said if you don't notice those certain things, are there any nuggets that you could give someone maybe just starting out, or perhaps any resources that you could direct them to for starting to get better at reading people and at picking up on those things?
Yeah, I have a new book that just came out on that exact subject called 6-Minute X-Ray. And I spent 22 years writing that thing and perfecting this system. This was the actual course. This book is a word for word almost course that intelligence agencies get from me. So foreign intelligence agencies, American intelligence agencies, and psychological warfare units train in this. And it's rapid behavior profiling. So guaranteed that you'll have a complete behavioral profile in 6 minutes or less. 6 minutes is a worst case scenario. So a couple of things, if you want to buy the book, I think it's just a few bucks on Amazon. But some of the really high leverage indicators that you need to be looking for, if you're talking to a client and you see a change, so if you're a behavior profiler, you're not just saying, oh, that guy scratched his butt. That means, you know, he has three poodles and is also overeats ice cream. So they're looking for one thing that means a bunch of things. And that's not how it works. And a lot of people, even in the field who call themselves experts, think that that's how it works. What we're really looking for is change detection. So I understand how a person operates, takes maybe 20 seconds to do that. And then I'm looking for differences in that behavior. And some of these are the way the person moves their eyes. And I tend to focus on the eyes a lot because that's where we look during conversations most of the time. So there's something out there in neurolinguistic programming called eye accessing cues. Absolutely disproven, thousands of times upon thousands. Even the guys who invented it have admitted that it was severely flawed and probably, you know, shouldn't be taught. So those aren't my words. But you can prove it to yourself that there is something about the eyes, but everyone's different. It's not like someone's logical and then creative on one side. It's not how the brain works. And I would publicly challenge anyone on Zoom, live call to prove me wrong. But there are certain things that we do as individuals, and you can prove this to yourself right now. And I'll prove it to you. I'll use Lori as an example here. So Lori, what is the fifth word of the Pledge of Allegiance? So her natural home, if I'm looking at, I have no idea what it is. Okay. So Lori's natural home is, if I'm looking at Lori, is about 1 o'clock for me. So it would be her 11 o'clock. So I know if I'm asking her to recall like a similar piece of data, I'm going to look for a deviation. If she looks a different way, that's going to be a big deal. And it's not lie detection. What we're doing here is I'm detecting a difference. So if I've been asking you or a client about their family for 10 or 15 minutes or their smoking habits or overeating, and then I ask like, well, what about, are you doing pretty good financially? And all of a sudden their eyes go a completely different direction. I know as a therapist or a clinician, I either A, am never going to talk about that again, B, I need to ask a few more questions, or C, that's probably where the therapy needs to happen. Or that's one of the key pain points that they just either unconsciously don't want to talk about or are consciously concealing from me. And my job is results. My job is not to build rapport. My job is to produce results.
I remember you saying that women tend to be better natural body readers than men. And I've read, I don't know how you feel about this guy, but I read Joe Navarro's book and I was equally fascinated what's that? Oh, is it right there?
I have it right here on my desk. Yeah.
I was absolutely fascinated by it, but it was kind of overwhelming to me because I feel like I kind of do a lot of, like, I'm always picking up on things, but I don't know why. And so when one of the things that we learn as hypnotists is to calibrate, to watch for shifts in the body. And I really tried to, watch for specific things and catch eye accessing cues. But I find for me that when I just get into the zone with that person and I just sense into them that I notice, just really subtle. And it's like a lot of times I don't even know what I'm noticing, but I feel like I pick up on almost like, I would say like an energetic shift. Will you talk, am I just way off base here, or talk to me a little bit about that?
No, it's been proven many times that women are far better than men at decoding and unconsciously interpreting nonverbal communication. So I think that's one of the big things, or one of the big sources of what we call women's intuition, is that. The second source there is we call the brain gray matter. The white matter is what's really important. There's white matter in our brain. The reason the outside is gray is because it doesn't have fat layers around the axons of the brain cells. And those little fat layers are just like the wrapping around your phone charger, so you don't shock yourself. So it's just to conduct electricity. So the white matter is the connective tissue all throughout the brain that houses all of our electrical properties. And about 40 to 50% of the calories and food that you eat each day go straight to producing chemicals in your brain and electricity. It takes up a ton of power. And that white matter in the brain is what is our messenger systems. So that's called myelinated axons, if you want to get into the technical side. But it's just a little like a Cat4 phone cable between all the pieces of the brain. The biggest one in the brain is called the corpus callosum. So we have a left and a right hemisphere, but they talk to each other using white matter that's between them called the corpus callosum. And women's has proven to be always bigger than men's. So women have a lot more connective tissue between the hemispheres of the brain, which is why they're able to piece those things together so quickly, because the corpus callosum is here and our little animal brain or midbrain stuff is sitting right underneath it. The part of our brain that decodes nonverbal behavior is inside of that animal brain. And the reason we get gut feelings and we don't know what we really see is because that little animal brain can't speak English or can't speak any language. It's not capable of language processing. So it gives you a feeling because it says, hey, I see a bunch of stuff going on here, but I can't speak. I don't know what language is, but I have a bunch of chemicals here. I'm going to just squirt a bunch of these chemicals in Lori and give her a feeling about what's going on right now. So that's how it's trying to give us a readout, because that thing, if you think about it, language, us just talking to each other, is really new for our species. That's why we're not born with language yet. Yet. I think it'll be another 10 million years. Maybe that'll happen. But I think that's where that comes from. We've been talking to each other so long, non-verbally. And that's why the face is the most expressive part, because we would stand over the tall grass plains, either standing over the plain to see approaching predators or standing over the plain to communicate with each other non-verbally with our eyebrows, which is what all the experts call the billboard of our communication. And our eyes, which is why that we developed this white part of the eye. So I could signal, I could tell you exactly where a threat was from a long distance, non-verbally. And Greg Hartley is on the behavior panel with me, which is our YouTube channel. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have.
We break down a bunch of interviews, and it's all four of us are behavioral experts. It's a whole lot of fun. We break down expert interviews with these people, say, here's how to tell if they're truthful or deceptive. And we do it from an academic standpoint, not like the other body language stuff that I've seen out there. And a lot of us are students of Joe Navarro as well. And I like his work because it's rooted in science and research and results, which is pretty much where we should get everything we use.
Yeah, that makes me feel better because I do find his stuff fascinating. I feel like for someone listening to that show, tell me again what your show is called, where you break down people's body language.
The behavior panel.
I feel like that would be an excellent way for a training hypnotist to come in and start to familiarize themselves with these different cues and hone their skill of calibrating.
I absolutely agree. And that's one of those things that comes out of us so unconsciously. And I think that's what makes it a reliable indicator.
Yeah.
And we're not just analyzing someone for lie detection or anything like that. I'm analyzing to see, because my job is to dig down and figure out what the problem is with a client. Then I need to know what's really going on, because what they're telling me, every single client is going to lie to you. Every client will lie to you. So You're not trying to catch them out in a lie. You're not trying to call them out. You're not trying to get a confession. You are trying to find the root of problems, I would imagine. I'm not a clinician, but we're trying to find where these things come from. And sometimes the brain says, nope, I'm not going to tell her that. You're going to hide it. So the person's conscious brain is going, okay, I'm just going to give you some other stuff.
Yeah, I tell people, I believe the body is the unconscious mind. And if you can start to tune into the body and figure out what the body is doing, I also think that there's like a recipe, a kinesthetic recipe for every problematic behavior. And when you start to uncover what they're doing with their body and where they feel it in their body when they're stuck in that problem, you can begin to shift it and transform it, and it becomes malleable.
So true. My dog is having a dream right now.
Oh, I don't hear it.
In her sleep. Oh, good.
Do you, Chase, so this is a question that's been in the back of my mind ever since I heard you speak. And when I was a teenager, actually all growing up, I had a speech impediment. And as a teen, I went and saw a speech therapist and she helped me fix it. But I was so nervous to start trying it. Like I was afraid if I tried my sound was it like came out the sides of my mouth and was really messy. So I would talk about how Jesus loves me at church, and it was really embarrassing. So I sat down and I would just read books out loud for hours and hours and practice that new speech pattern and practice making my J sounds correctly and my Ch sounds correctly. And so I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about you teaching people to step into confidence and to utilize these characteristics and give yourself permission. And I'm wondering if there's some way that you would recommend a person beginning to practice that skill and begin to, you know, how do they find the bravery to actually do it, to go and see that first client and to sit down and to be confident and to give that client permission to then do something out of the ordinary?
I think what it should come down to is a baby step process, that they do it with someone. Of course, that's where we go through all of our training. We cut our teeth on training. And if we're not confident in training, we're not going to be confident in real life, because we'll typically default when we start freaking out or panicking, we will default to the lowest level of the thing we did repetitively. So if that was to feel low levels of confidence, that's the automatic default. So I would say the first thing would be to give yourself that permission and design everything in your office or wherever you're doing this therapy to reflect what makes you confident, because that's going to transfer automatically into the patient or into the, I can't say patient here, right?
Client. You can say anything you want.
So we want that to transfer. And I think if we get the first one out of the way, start the confidence outside the clinic completely. You don't need it. Walking into the clinic is not like, okay, I need to turn on my confidence button now. If it's not on all the time and you haven't experienced it elsewhere in your life, the evidence, which our brain is looking for permission, doesn't exist. So then it becomes, okay, I'm going to turn on my pretend confidence. And it's a stage show at that point. So that's when every day we're asking ourselves, or we need to be asking ourselves the question, what would happen if I spoke a little bit more clearly and more confidently and made better eye contact with someone? What would happen if I started a conversation with a complete stranger? So think about things, and everybody's a little different, but think for yourself, what would be just an inch outside of your comfort zone and still make other people, leaving people better than you found them, of course. But what would be an inch outside your comfort zone? And then once you're in that scenario, say, what are the actual consequences if I do this? And start proving to yourself. So now guess what? You're gathering the evidence that you need. Even if it's small, that evidence gives you permission for the next inch. And then once you have a couple, it's a snowball effect. Then you'll say, okay, I'm going to step way outside of the comfort zone this time because nothing has ever really happened. It won't. So what we're doing is racking up evidence to convince a dog brain in the middle of our head, inside of a 3-pound sack of meat that runs on electricity and chemicals, that it's okay to stand up straight and use a loud or a confident voice.
I love that question. What would happen if? I think that asking ourselves the right question can trigger such a powerful response. And I found that the brain seems to kind of be tuned for questions. Like when we ask a question, the brain has to look for an answer. So I think anyone listening should write down that empowering question. What would happen if I just did this thing? Chase, when you think about, I believe you joined the military when you were 17, yes?
Yes, 17.
And did you feel that confidence at 17? And if not, what helped you cultivate that and step into confidence yourself? Do you remember that journey? And can you share that with us?
Yeah, I was absolutely ridden with social anxiety. And I got in the military. I was on a deployment on my 18th birthday. I was on an overseas deployment. And I started learning some of this body language and behavioral profiling stuff at a younger age. And every time I learned a little bit more, I started seeing what was really going on with other people. And I thought I was reading everything wrong because there was a big mistake. I thought there was a big mistake because everyone had the same quality and everyone looked like they were hiding suffering. So my mentor at the time is a 74-year-old retired government guy. And I told him this. I'm like, it just looks like the only real body language I'm seeing from people is that they're hiding how much they're suffering. He said, that's the universal human condition. That is, every human you will ever meet is hiding suffering or hiding shame. There are no exceptions. And that's the reason I was seeing that. So knowing that it was true, I never felt like I was superior to anybody, because everyone screwed up. Everybody screwed up. So why wouldn't I talk to that person who looks confident, because I know they're faking? And I know they're just as screwed up as I am. So for me, it made other people human. So I thought, wow, that person's just like me. They might look a little different because they have permission to do that. They've given themselves permission to do that, but they're the same as I am. And over time, I think the way that we do this, the way that we interact with people, is reliant on how friendly we see the world. So whether or not you view the world as a general friendly place will be what you pick up on. And I think this is maybe beating a dead horse, or beating someone else's dead horse, because it's been said before. But if you go buy a new car, that's all you're going to see. You're going to see that I just bought a brand new pickup truck. I'm driving out here around Virginia. That's all I see. I'm like, wow, everyone went out and got the same truck that I got. But they didn't. They didn't at all. The animal part of my brain, which is called the reticular activation system, it's actually closer to the brainstem. It says, okay, Chase thinks this is really important. This truck is really important to Chase. So I'm gonna show him where they are. But it was only important because I was emotional about it.
Oh.
I felt an emotion surrounding the truck, which is, that goes back to that fate model, focus, authority, tribe, and emotion. The brain said, that's important. I'm going to memorize that and try to find more. So when we view people as negative or hurtful or a-holes or whatever, that's what our brain says. Okay, Lori thinks that's important. I'm going to go find it. So then the people who view the world that way tend to see that evidence, and it produces evidence. So everything in our brain is about some kind of evidence. Like, I've seen that before. And if you think about it, that kept us alive. That goes back to the F and focus. We're looking for evidence. We're looking for something, grabs our focus, and we immediately start searching for some kind of evidence. Because if I see a striped thing that's orange and black sticking up over the grass, that's probably not a harmless butterfly. That's probably a tail of a tiger coming through. And if you're going back 200,000 years, just imagine you went out every day and you went out and stabbed an animal or caught a bunch of fish or picked berries and came back to the village at the end of every day. This is a long time ago. And one day you're dragging that big sack of whatever behind you back to the village, and you pass a bush. It's the same bush that you pass every day. So big ass green bush, you pass by it every day, not a big deal. But today when you pass by it, a stick snaps behind that bush. Now our focus is triggered. And typically, if we want to get into this some other time, but when we have a script that we're following and everyone's following a script, Lori's been on a Zoom meeting probably 400 times in the last year, as many of you have. So our brain's done this so many times that there's a script. There's an expectation that when I look, here's my camera, which I'm looking at now. So I'm tricking you into thinking that we're making eye contact. But when I look back down at Lori, I expect to see her there. I expect for the computer fan to be running and all of these expectations. So when we have a script for driving the car, for speaking to somebody, for shaking someone's hand, which we've all learned this handshake induction thing, when that script is broken, that person's script, walking by the bush and the stick breaks, that's a script, a memorized path, and something broke behind the bush. So that's called novelty. Something brand new is happening. Our brain says, this is different and I need to pay attention. So focus is our number one currency, the number one thing we need from other people. we need to be able to generate novelty. And one of the biggest ways to do that is to be confident about what's going on. You have to be confident enough to make that situation different than something they've experienced before. Because if I have people sitting in the waiting room and the waiting room has crystals or waterfalls or stuff like that, I'm going to trigger a script. This is when they're sitting at the nail salon. This is when they're sitting there to get a massage. And if I want them to view me as a higher level than a nail salon or a spa, I'm going to change the waiting room. I'm going to make it look like a doctor's office. I'm going to maybe even put some betadine or something in that little smoke diffuser thing to make it smell like a doctor's office. So what that's going to do, the brain says, okay, I've been in an environment like this before. And what happens when we're in a doctor's office? We're 10 times more responsive to the authority of the person in front of us. There's even an entire academic paper written about this. It's called white coat syndrome. Even people who receive fatal diagnoses incorrectly still died because this is so powerful. So if I'm in the business of getting some rapid change out of a human being, I want to ramp up every level that I can. And it's going to start with that. I'm either A, going to break them from the script, or B, I'm going to jab them down, push them into the script of their brain saying, okay, this is just like the doctor's office. The clipboards are the same. The pens are the same. It smells very similar. It's white. The furniture is very clean. Then I'm going to trigger as much as I can to make their brain borrow from a script. So if we were in person right now, or you at one of my seminars and I'm standing up in the front of the room, I'm talking, you're kind of looking up and down, taking a bunch of notes, you've never been at one of my seminars before. You've probably never been in this room before. You've obviously never been in a room with me, most likely. So your brain doesn't know what to do. So your brain says, oh, this is just like college. It's the same thing. There's a dude up there talking about some stuff, and I'm writing some stuff down that the dude is saying. That's college. I'm going to borrow from that script. So it starts taking that script. And if we know, this is getting into a little, some of the advanced stuff, but if we know how a person's running a script, if I know that you're borrowing a script from college, I can start doing stuff to make you more obedient to the authority of the teacher. I know for a fact that if you're borrowing from a script from college, you're worried about your social behavior, how other people are seeing you. I know you're worried about being quiet. I know if I yell really loud that it's going to break your college script and your brain's going to say, whoop, that was not in the college script. I need to pay a lot of attention. So I can either push you further into a script and make you more compliant, because that script, I'm in college class, says to be compliant. So if I know how to put you into a script and I know how to break you out of a script, I can either get the result I want just from plugging you into a certain script, or I can break it and just generate a tremendous amount of focus because there's something new happening. And that gives me an opportunity to do some serious work with a person.
That is intriguing. I'm trying to think how this could work over Zoom, like what kind of a setting I could build behind me. Like, you have a really awesome, is this a virtual background behind you? Or a real background?
Oh, it's my desk.
Oh, I love it. Okay. I thought it was, because a lot of times you see like tracers when someone has a virtual background, but I'm trying to think what kind of how you could create that experience over Zoom, and how you could create that essentially a feeling of prestige and plug in someone's script for authority on Zoom.
So it's if we're doing it on Zoom, all we're going to need to do is subvert expectations a little bit. So in marketing and in intelligence training, they call it the subversion of expectations.
Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So if you're expecting a certain thing, or to see or read or experience something, doing something opposite of that will generate the response. So I think Zoom is different for everybody. There's Zoom yoga class, and then there's Zoom executive business meeting. That would have two very different things. Those are two very different scripts. So me showing up to yoga class with no shirt on, probably not a big deal. The business meeting part, probably a big deal. So we have to think of the, remember FATE, fate, tribe is number three. You have to think of that tribe and what that tribe is expecting. So maybe do that. Something that has that off, a little bit off.
Okay. I'm going to be, my wheels are going to be spinning. A couple years ago, I accidentally stumbled on, I start all my group Zoom meetings by having everyone bring their hands to their heart and do just kind of a guided visualization where they imagine connecting with one another. And I think that might be a little bit of that novelty piece where it's not something that they do on all the rest. You know, usually the one person comes up and they just start talking and you're expected to engage, kind of like that high school or college lecture. And yeah. It's like a massive way to build group rapport. And, but my wheels are spinning now. I love this. Can you talk to me about how, I know you teach a lot about how important the role of appearance is when you're portraying confidence. How would a woman, because it seems like it's so easy for a man to put on a power suit. And so I'm wondering how you would help a woman step into portray herself as confident with her appearance and still keep some femininity. And are those two the antithesis of one another? Can a woman be confident and feminine at the same time? Or does she have to sacrifice femininity for confidence?
Yeah, so I think absolutely. So confidence does not mean masculinity at all. Confidence can be in anybody that you see. It means that a person, if we think of the word confidence, that means an assuredness. I have confidence that this person's going to do this. I'm assured. So that means we have a generalized expectation that the outcomes in the very immediate future are going to be positive. I'm not saying I'm going to win the lottery tomorrow, but I am saying I'm going to have a generally positive experience no matter what happens. And I have thought ahead more than other people. I've planned ahead a little bit more than everybody else. And even if this comes down to like, you know where the fire extinguishers are out in the hallway and nobody else does, feel confident about that. So I think confidence can show absolutely. I think confidence and femininity can go 100% hand in hand with each other. Because I think that true confidence, fake confidence in women, I don't think it looks feminine. I think it looks insecure, just like it does in a man. It's the exact same thing. So true confidence in women is inspirational, and I think it's very feminine.
That's awesome. Thank you.
It's contagious.
I love it. So before we close, is there anything, you know, thinking of the listener who is perhaps a person who really wants to start using these tools, is afraid to get started? And I know there are a lot of seasoned hypnotists listening who are already using the tools, but we can all, I know myself included, can certainly use a confidence boost. Is there anything that you would like to leave the listener with? As I feel like I'm asking you this huge question right now, but just as an overarching theme to think about when they get ready to go into that next session or into that first session.
I think the way that you view your own, not skill level, but what you're doing for the other person should be the root of your confidence. So the confidence should not come from, I've been doing hypnosis for 20 years. That's an argument from authority. I know people who've been in the military for 30 years and suck at it. They're horrible. I know people who've been doing hypnosis for 40 years and teach classes on it, and they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. And there's 19, 20-year-olds out there, even on Instagram, that are smoking it. They are smoking it. That's all really comes down to how they're viewing, not their skill level, but what they're viewing as, like, I'm giving this person a gift. I'm doing this person an absolute favor. Instead of thinking, oh God, I'm so glad they allowed me to do this to them. I hope to God it works. It's a gift. At a minimum, bare minimum, you have to set yourself a failure goal. Like, I'm going to at least get one failure a week, and it's not a big deal because you're learning. You know, Milton Erickson, same thing. It was just kind of, all the videos we see of him are just like Instagram. It's just the highlight reel. He failed, I'm sure, thousands of times.
Yeah.
So that's you've got to know that everyone fails. But most people fail in the dark. We just don't hear about it.
That's so brilliant. Thank you so much. Chase, for anyone listening, you've talked about the 6-minute x-ray. We talked a bit about the ellipsis manual. What would be the next best step for someone who wants to learn more about what you do or get more involved in learning these valuable tools?
Thanks. If you just type Chase Hughes into Google, you'll see all kinds of stuff, or you can go to chasehughes.com. And if you want to connect with me, my interns check a bunch of other stuff. But if you connect me on Instagram, I actually check those messages. It's actually me.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chase. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
I'm so grateful you've listened all the way to the end. What is one tiny action step you'll take now based on an aha moment you got during the podcast? Maybe that life-changing action step is to come accept the gift I have for you at theimpostermonster.com. Head there right now to get your powerful hypnosis audio, The Answer Room, that lets you make important decisions and get crystal clear about your next step forward on this path of purpose in your one great and precious life.